Okay, now we can start.
Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA.
If you build it, they will come. Joel, seen that movie? He's in the movie, Joe.
Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA.
Jordan Malley. Jordan, great to see you. Through our 670 scores scope. Yep.
Where is he?
And it's right over there, Bill.
Did Matt Peck get a signed copy of that book?
No, Matt Peck, he didn't know. No. I'll talk to D. Rose.
Yeah, guys.
Matt, well, you will be getting your book soon.
Kick back and get ready for the best hour of your day.
Are players buying in, Jim?
Yes.
Fair enough.
And so all I was saying on this podcast, the Locked On Bulls podcast.
Locked On Bulls starts now.
The Locked On Bulls podcast.
You can just see the vibe.
Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Today's episode of Locked On Bulls is sponsored by Built Bar. My name is Jordan Malley. Along with me is Matt Peck. Follow us on Twitter at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls underscore Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Hit us up on our text and voicemail line, 331-979-1369. All your texts, all your voicemails, anything you got for us, 331-979-1369. And your tweets at Locked On Bulls, at Jordan C. Malley, and at Bulls underscore Peck. Matt, welcome back from the weekend. Hopefully you enjoyed 5 and 6 last night. I did. We got a lot of juicy details. More on the darker side of things for 5 and 6. And also reminiscing about one of the teams my dad talks about all the time, still to this day, and that's the Dream Team. But first and foremost, before we dive into all of that, how are you? How was your weekend? And how you doing?
What up, Jordan? What's up, Bulls Nation? Had a wonderful time watching The Last Dance last night. As so many people who got the exclusive sneak peek of this, you know, members of the media who got at least the first 8 episodes ahead of its airing. Like, I heard so many people saying, dude, after the first 2 episodes, it just keeps getting better. It just keeps getting better. Just wait. And I loved these episodes because, we got so much. So much of the story, the Dream Team, Tony Kukoc's, the way that he's introduced to the story of the Bulls dynasty, you know, playing for that Croatian national team, the absence of Isaiah Thomas from the Dream Team and all of the people who had an opinion about that. But mostly to me, the episodes last night, especially episode 6, was about the dark side of becoming the global icon that was MJ. And I loved how they started that 6th episode with those repeated takes of him sitting in that chair with the camera crew saying over and over again, you know, a lot of people wonder what it's like to be Michael Jordan for a day or a week, but, you know, it's not that fun. And, you know, I promise you, you wouldn't want to be Michael Jordan for a year, because you also get those other moments where you're, whether it's flash forward in 98, him sitting in the hotel room being like, man, I'm so done with this stuff. I'm done with it. Or just all of the media scrums and all the scrutiny that he faced during their 93 playoff run about the gambling and the trip to Atlantic City and all that. I mean, you really started to get a very solid understanding of how much MJ came to hate the fame side of his life.
Roll sound.
Rolling. 2.
It's funny, a lot of people say they like to be Michael Jordan for a day or for a week, but let them try to be Michael Jordan for a year, see if they like it.
Marlon, 2.
And it's funny, a lot of people told me that they like to be Michael Jordan for a day or for a week, but I don't think you can see the true Michael Jordan for just a day.
5, 6, and 2.
Rolling. Cameras.
It's funny, a lot of people say they'd like to try to be Michael Jordan for a day or for a week, but I don't think they quite understand that it's no fun.
I'm glad you brought that up as the first thing that we're kind of touching on here, because I felt like out of anything, Matt, of those 120 minutes we watched last night, that kind of stuck with me most. And I thought it was very impactful that they started the episode with it, because they kind of trailed the 6th episode, like leading us out and teasing us for next week with where they kind of started in the 6th episode with a lot of the struggles, but going more towards the basketball side of things rather than the off-court stuff. But I think it was just one of the many layers that you can peel back. And Michael Jordan and the way he was covered in the 90s is kind of like an onion. You just just keep peeling layers and layers back, and you find more interesting and juicy details. But for whatever reason, Matt, this one stuck with me, and I think about a lot of superstar athletes and just celebrities in general. You know, you hear so many of them talk about you get to a point in your stardom where it feels like you're isolated, feels like you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything. You almost feel like a caged animal, and MJ even talked about that. He said felt like the only peace he ever had was sitting here in this hotel room by himself smoking a cigar and just relaxing for an hour.
Yeah, and it's definitely a sad part of the MJ story. And you know, it's obvious it's not something exclusive to MJ. It's something that famous people of all kinds deal with. And it's crazy to think about how open and eager to participate in the world of media and social media that today's athletes deal with. You know, like my buddy John Sabine from Outsiders had a funny tweet last night as we were watching the doc. Like, you know, there was that one clip where Scotty and MJ and Harper all sitting around drinking beers after a game in the season. And Scotty's like, man, what are you doing filming us drinking these beers? I don't want you filming us drinking these beers. And we got fast forward to today and LeBron's all over Instagram yelling about Taco Tuesday. And it just seems like, in some way, it's like today's athletes are not necessarily attention whores, but are so okay and used to the world of social media that we live in. Whereas back then, you know, obviously some NBA players got some level of attention, especially that 98 team that was treated like the Beatles, where, you know, it's like, you know, even Bill Wennington and Judd Bushler were getting attention from fans. But MJ, of course, was always at the crux of that, at the center of that. And even just some of the shots, some of the still shots and some of the clips we see of MJ just surrounded by media. And I mean, like 360 degrees surrounded. You felt claustrophobic watching it.
Yeah, I've noticed as I've kind of gotten a little bit older, and I still love going to concerts and stuff, but just the idea of that many people being right on top of you for every second of your day for what, 15 years straight, 12 years straight, I mean, I don't know how he would do it. I don't understand it. And that's why, like, I keep continuing going back to, like, that sad moment at the beginning of the sixth episode where it's like, truly none of us had any idea what it was like to be him. And, you know, you see him, and what's so unique about him and unique about maybe even Kobe Bryant in some respects is the fact that no matter what was said, no matter what was done, no matter how much stress either one of those guys had piled on them, they were always calm, cool, collective in the moment. They had their moments here and there where they would lash out, things would backfire, but for the most part, you never saw MJ get outlandish with the media. I mean, he did go on his media silence for 2 weeks, but I mean, that's probably the extent to which MJ kind of had a retaliation in some respects. But for the most part, both of those guys, cool and calm under pressure and extremely unique. I would say, what, 99 out of 100 people would fail in that instance, and it takes a really unique individual to do the things that MJ and Kobe were able to do. And I thought that was really cool too, Matt, at the beginning of the episode 5 where they're talking about Kobe, and Kobe comes in too from his interview and says, you know, I hate the conversation about MJ versus Kobe because there is no Kobe Bryant without Michael Jordan. There's no 5 championships without Michael Jordan. So to hear me being compared and asked who would beat who one-on-one, I hate that conversation. I thought that was really cool, and it was really cool to hear MJ's side of things about Kobe early on.
Yeah, it was. And he spoke very highly of Kobe and talked about how Kobe was very eager to learn. And you have those great shots in the doc of MJ and Kobe, you know, standing next to each other during like a pause and play in the 98 All-Star game at Madison Square Garden. And it's just like such iconic thing to look at. Because, of course, we all know what Kobe Bryant went on to do. But at the time, he was a 19-year-old kid playing in the All-Star game. And MJ is in what everyone at the time already knows and believes to be his final season, his final All-Star game. I think it's interesting that, you know, because in Kobe's, in the eulogy he gave at Kobe's memorial service just a couple months ago, which, you know, it's crazy to think about, MJ had, you know, in kind of a joking way, talked about how persistent Kobe was in bugging him and bugging him and bugging him about, you know, MJ, teach me about this, give me advice about that. And I think in some degree, MJ kind of, even from an early stage, recognized that level of persistence and competition in Kobe and saw a little bit of himself in Kobe. And because of that, was willing to lend his advice and to lend his guidance and his mentorship and have that big brother, little brother relationship develop. But I think the other thing that maybe you don't think about as much, because you wonder, you know, why was MJ so nice to Kobe? You know, like, Pete, you know, at the time he was just a kid. He was talented, but he was just a kid. Whereas like MJ was ruthless with his, you know, with his contemporaries. Maybe an element is that MJ knew, even when he was playing in that All-Star game in 98, or the times, you know, the couple of times that he played a young Kobe's Lakers teams in the late 90s, that MJ was on his way out and that Kobe was not going to be a threat to him on the court at any point before MJ hung him up. And so maybe that was a factor in opening himself up a little bit and letting Kobe in a little bit, because he didn't have to protect himself against Kobe. Instead was just, you know, I can, you know, impart my wisdom on this kid, put the NBA in good hands, and I don't need to worry about being nice to this guy, because I don't need to worry about beating this guy, because I, like Magic, I ain't going to be here.
It's funny. I think about that in a lot of ways, and I think about, too, since we're talking about players talking about their skill compared to MJ, how about Charles Barkley, too? And we were laughing about it last week when I read you that tweet. And sure enough, this comes up in this episode. So it must have been somebody who had pre-releases to the episodes. But it was a quote about Charles Barkley saying, "The first time I really understood that there was somebody better than me at basketball in this world, there's a better player on this planet than me, was when MJ kicked my ass and averaged, what, 50 points per game or 41 points per game in the finals against them, up against the Suns." I thought that was pretty impactful, but it also left me kind of scratching my head. I'm like, Charles Barkley really thought at one point in time he was better than Michael Jordan? And I guess maybe that creeps into your mind when you beat him out for MVP one year. But MJ even said it, and he kind of laughed. He's like, "Hey, you might have gotten the MVP, but I got the thing that was most important. That was the championship."
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Charles is crazy to have thought that at the time. I mean, you mentioned he was the MVP in the 92-93 regular season. And some might say, "Oh, that, you know, that's just like D Rose's MVP when it probably should have been LeBron." But people get sick of giving the MVP to the same guy year in and year out, so you do a change of pace kind of thing. But no, Chuck was insane in that season. He was so damn good, and it wasn't just that MVP in the regular season. Obviously, MJ is a big part of what made the Dream Team as famous as it was. And of course, they talked about the global significance and the cultural significance of that basketball team in 92. And he was certainly the most famous face of it. But go back and look at those games that the 92 Dream Team played. You can make the argument that Charles Barkley was the most dominant player on that team, not Michael Jordan. I mean, statistically, he led that team in scoring. Charles Barkley was arguably the MVP of the greatest basketball team of all time, the 92 Dream Team. So in that sense, I don't think it's insane for Barkley to say, "Well, yeah, it took the 93 finals for me to realize that MJ was actually a better basketball player than me." Because guess what? Charles Barkley in those 93 finals averaged 27, 13, and 5. Like, dude was a beast, which, you know, again, by the way, parentheses, Draymond Green, God, I hope you watched that part of the doc and shut your face for the rest of time. My God, Charles Barkley is a fucking legend. I know a lot of younger NBA fans only know him as Chuck from Inside the NBA, you know, TNT pregame, halftime, and postgame. The man was a killer on the court.
Come on, man.
I think the funny thing is, too, is, you know, I was trying to ask a lot of people, too, about that era, and I'm like, why do you think, if you thought MJ had a better season in 92-93 than Charles Barkley did, was there a certain reason why MJ didn't end up winning? Because there was an argument to be had that he had a better season than Barkley, not to take anything away from Barkley, but a lot of people were saying that MJ, that people maybe in the media and maybe fans sort of had a little bit of MJ fatigue at the time and a little bit of fatigue of the Bulls winning. And when somebody said that, it reminded me of kind of like LeBron in the modern era, is those years where LeBron hasn't won an MVP, there was definitely an argument to be made that LeBron was the best player in the world and should have won the MVP, but there was years where other guys had just better overall seasons, and I think a lot of the LeBron fatigue kind of kicked in. Think about James Harden's MVP. I think about Russell Westbrook's MVP. So I think, and even Steph Curry's
and
MVP.
Chicago fans don't like to admit it, but Derrick Rose's MVP.
That's true. That's true. I always talk about that I thought maybe, you know, and there's a lot of argument to be had that Dwight Howard should have won the MVP that year, not Derrick Rose. But then again, back to like the whole fatigue. Did you feel that, like, as somebody who's watching this through the 90s, did you feel at any point throughout this 90s dynasty, and maybe it's hard to tell because we were here in Chicago and so were you, but that there was any fatigue at all from MJ? Because Les was telling me even that there was three writers in Chicago who didn't vote for MJ for MVP that year and voted for Charles Barkley, and when Karl Malone ended up winning the MVP over MJ one of the years, that they voted for Karl Malone instead.
Yeah, I absolutely think it's a real element to how people feel about athletes. Because you mentioned the LeBron fatigue and we're talking MJ fatigue. You could also make an argument that at least one of Steve Nash's MVPs were because of Kobe Bryant fatigue. Like, it's a thing that keeps recurring. It comes up in this league time and again. And I think very much so there was a fatigue around MJ and the Bulls and the winning. And it's like a couple different reporters and journalists who were interviewed for this, I can't remember who, saying things like, you know, we build people up to tear them down. The media builds people up to tear them down. And that's kind of a big theme that you saw in these episodes about MJ specifically and also the Bulls. And it's like when teams win a lot and when people win a lot, people start hating them for the winning. It's the reason people hate the Patriots. It's the reason people hate the New York Yankees. And it's a reason why outside of Chicago in the 90s, a lot of people hated the Bulls. Like, in one way, they were the country's team and the world's team in the 90s because of the popularity and the popularity that the league built based on the success of this team and this one player. But yeah, there was plenty of people who were sick of the Bulls at that point. And I think all of the different elements that went into that, and especially when attacking MJ specifically, and, you know, where are the warts on this person? Because we're running commercials, say, hey, you want to be like Mike, drink Gatorade, you know, and then, well, let's figure out where the flaws are with this individual, and let's see what skeletons are in his closet. Because, hey, amazing, awesome guy, super athlete, super charismatic, wins everything, really charming, is fun. But after a while, that gets stale with the media. And the media wants something different. And the media wants something dirty to talk about. And so much of the gambling stuff, I think, was way overblown. And he just got sick of the questions to the point where, I love that in the doc, because I hadn't remembered that specifically, but before game one of the NBA Finals in 93, he said to Ahmad Rashad, hey, let's sit down and do an interview because I'm sick of people talking about this. I want to clear the air. I mean, there was media fatigue of Jordan and there was Jordan fatigue of media, and it got ugly.
Before we go to Tony Kukoc, I do want to make a point on that. Just because you brought that up, it reminds me very much, and MJ didn't, at least I feel like, MJ didn't play a villain in the same sense that LeBron played a villain necessarily. Maybe to other fan bases they did. And the hate that you and I had for LeBron when he played for the Heat at the time was, I think, unparalleled. And I think there's still Bulls fans in my generation, and maybe Matt, even yours too, that still have a ton of hate for LeBron as far as his game goes. But maybe that's MJ's version of just of LeBron's sort of villainism. And maybe Knicks fans, and there probably are Knicks fans and Lakers fans that absolutely hate MJ, and even Detroit Pistons fans probably feel the same way that we felt about LeBron in the early 2010s. But yeah, can you just imagine, though, like LeBron or Steph Curry not talking to the media for 3-4 weeks, and then all of a sudden, right before a massive game, you're walking into the arena and the number one icon in the world just grabs you and says, yeah, let's do a sit down interview right now. I need to get something off my chest. As a journalist or somebody who's trying to conduct an interview, I'd be shitting my pants. I'd be like, are you serious? We're about to do this right now. But good on Ahmad Rashad. And Matt, I didn't know this about him. I saw a tweet. Somebody said that people forget that he was a 4-time Pro Bowl wide receiver before he was even in the media. So I had no idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching Ahmad Rashad religiously. Those, those shows that they would do, Inside Stuff and all that. I mean, and you could tell, he clearly had the trust of MJ. MJ chose certain people to be in his circle of trust, media and otherwise. And not only that interview before the 93 finals, but when Ahmad Rashad is riding with MJ in his Range Rover to the stadium on game day, and talking with MJ about this and that and what's being said about him. And it was just like, wow, clearly that was somebody that MJ trusted to conduct this interview. Because I think MJ was always aware of the fact that once he became as famous as he did, plenty of people would like to take his words and twist them, which is a perfect example of that is something that we got into a lot in the doc when he didn't speak out and endorse the African-American Democratic candidate in, a Senate race in North Carolina in 1990, when his, his opposition, the incumbent, who was basically like a Jim Crow South kind of Republican, who said horrible things, basically like a Dixiecrat. And everybody said, MJ, like, what the heck? Like, why aren't you endorsing this guy in your home state? And MJ's off-the-cuff remark of, well, Republicans buy sneakers too. That one little soundbite got twisted around and thrown back in his face a million times over. And people said, oh, he's a capitalist who only cares about his sneaker endorsement and his dollars earned instead of actually using his voice for good. It's like, no. Y'all blew up one little joke of a comment way portion. And truthfully, I just didn't feel informed enough on the matter to speak on the matter. And guess what? I'm also not a political advocate. I'm an athlete. But that's just one example of MJ and his difficult relationship with the media, because the media just wants and wants and wants from somebody that famous.
It is crazy. You don't see him hardly ever take sides on anything. And even in there, too, in the documentary, he says, he's like, I sent a contribution to the campaign. I just didn't come out and publicly endorse it. And then I got screwed on for one comment that I had made. And it's truly crazy to think about that. And, there's a lot of people too talking about that. I feel like they could have made a 90-minute episode just talking about MJ kind of steering his way out of the eye of talking about politics and anything that was major headline world news. MJ just was never that type of guy. And, I feel like it was unfair at times. And a lot of people brought this up on social media, too, was, Larry Bird wasn't asked to go out there and make comments about social and political issues. Magic Johnson wasn't asked at one point or another to do that until, of course, he was diagnosed mm-hmm. with AIDS. Then he was kind of the front runner, but all of these other stars in the NBA were not asked to do the same things and not critiqued and criticized like MJ was for not coming out and speaking publicly about this. So I think that is also a major part in this is, if you're going to talk about MJ that same way, then you need to talk about every other star player in the 90s who wasn't coming out and speaking about these issues if you're going to criticize and critique MJ.
Funny too, because you think about today's Venn diagram of athletics and politics, and what do so many people who are sports fans think and say? Hashtag stick to sports. And here's MJ, being in some way vilified for not speaking out about something political.
It's crazy. It's truly crazy. And that's what, I mean, we're what, 25 years removed? It doesn't seem like that long ago, but... And it really isn't in reality. There's a couple other things I want to hit on, Matt, and that one being Tony Kukoc, and also talking a little bit about some of the funny things we saw in these two episodes. But before I do that, mentioned our episode today is brought to you by Built Bar. And for our listeners out there, I can't tell you enough. I started a diet a couple of weeks ago. I went on this last year, basically like a hybrid version of keto and the Atkins diet. Very, very low carb. A lot of protein, a lot of water, a lot of fluids, hardly any fats, no fast food, no junk food, no sweets, no sugars. But there was this one thing that I struggled with, Matt, a lot, and that was being able to get up and get my body going for the day. I hate eating breakfast. Breakfast is the absolute worst meal of the day. I hate it. And it's not about the food. It's just I hate eating for the first like 4 hours I'm awake. Can't do it. But in order to get going, avoid those headaches and everything, I needed something. And so I used to eat granola bars. Wasn't enough. These Built Bars are fantastic for that. They're packed with protein, low in carbs, low in net carbs, and low in sugar, and gives you all of the energy and nutrients you need to get your day started. Locked On Bulls and the Locked On Podcast Network is offering you guys an exclusive offer of $10 off when you buy your first box at builtbars.com. That's builtbar.com. They have 10 flavors, 8 chocolates and nut free, and 8 with 100% chocolate and nuts in them. The flavors that they sent us, Matt, have been fantastic. I mean, I tried the peanut butter brownie one the other day. I had the banana nut one. Both of them are fantastic. And it's not like your traditional protein bar either. Sometimes you'll either get protein bars that feel like you're eating a piece of taffy where they're so hard and just, I don't know, have no flavor, or you get ones that are super chalky, just nasty. I wanted something that was a little bit in between, and these are like nothing I've ever had before. They're very chewy. The flavors are fantastic too, and it's not painful to eat through these. It's kind of like, honestly, I feel like it's more of a treat than anything else. So again, $10 off when you use the promo code LOCKEDON on your first order in your first box at BuiltBar.com. Built Bar is a great sponsor of ours and be sponsoring our shows all month long. So again, to get your offer, go to Locked On, use the promo code Locked On, save $10, go to builtbar.com. That's builtbar.com, $10 off. I shot a tweet out on Friday too with the pictures of some of the bars and the flavors. Be tweeting out pictures over the next couple of weeks. But if you guys do decide this, if you're on a diet as well, trying to stay in shape and avoid the Corin 15, some people are calling it, which makes me cringe even having to say that word. But yeah, if you're looking to lose some weight and you decide to try these, shoot us a tweet at us at Locked On Bulls, at Jordan C. Malley, and at Bulls underscore Peck. Matt, Tony Kukoc, this was a very interesting episode talking about him and also his kind of introduction to Pippen and Jordan and the Bulls as a whole, which was fascinating to me because I feel like out of anybody that played a very major key role in the 90s Bulls success, Tony Kukoc is by far somebody I knew the least about. And same thing with his career, but everybody talked about how so impactful he was. And man, he was a badass. After getting his ass whooped by MJ and Pippen, coming back in that second game and showing no mercy, I thought, showed a lot of guts. And even Michael Wilbon said the same thing, is like Americans didn't know how tough Tony was, and he came back, and even though he got embarrassed by Pippen and Jordan, he came back and showed and proved them why he could be a great part of this Bulls dynasty, and sure enough he was.
Yeah, I think it was cool that MJ and Scotty after the championship game, even though they won the gold medal, kind of both had a moment like, oh this kid can play. It's like, well, yeah, no duh. Like Jerry Krause, for all of his warts and faults and flaws that clearly are being exposed in this documentary because, you know, MJ wants it that way, the dude could scout. And so, yeah, maybe MJ and Scotty were offended that Jerry Krause was more obsessed with this kid from Croatia than he was appreciative of the guys who were currently winning titles for his, you know, his organization. And that they, for that reason, wanted to stick it to Tony Kukoc and stick to Tony Kukoc in the Olympics. Because for them, it wasn't Tony Kukoc in a Croatia jersey. It was Jerry Krause, who was just taller and skinnier and wearing a Croatia jersey. That's who they were beating. As Scotty said, anything to make Jerry look bad. Nothing personal against Tony. But guess what? Tony came over eventually. And as you said, and as Wilbon brought up in the doc, like, dude was tough. Dude had his reasons for staying in what was then Yugoslavia, what, you know, a war-torn country. And Tony saying, you know, I didn't want to leave during his time of war. And also, guess what? I was getting paid more to play Euroball than I would have made my first couple seasons in the NBA. Two very good reasons right there to not come over right away. But then he did come over, and he earned their respect. And was a huge critical piece of three title teams. And, you know, I know a lot of Bulls fans were saying, like, where's Tony through the first four episodes of the doc. But based on the timeline and the flashbacks of, you know, okay, here's what's going on in the 97-98 season. Now let's rewind to 1984 or 1986 or 1988. After we got the first championship in 91, at the tail end of last week's episodes, I figured that this is when we were going to get the Tony Kukoc stuff, because it would line up with the Dream Team and the Olympics in 92, which was the introduction of Tony Kukoc to the world. I couldn't help but laugh at all the people who were saying Tony Kukoc back Tony in those Kukoc. Old videos before he was famous.
Tony Kukoc.
And then Tony Kukoc. It was funny to listen to everybody just mispronounce his name constantly.
Tony Kukoc.
For somebody who loves when people mispronounce things, and I do it myself, it's just, it was fantastic. And yeah, like, you were right about, like, even Scotty said, he's like, Jerry Krause paved hell for Tony Kukoc, and it wasn't Tony's fault. And even MJ said the same thing. He's like, I had nothing against him, but I was so pissed off at Krause for being obsessed with this European star while we were over here in the midst of trying to win our third championship, or after winning our third championship. And it's just, he's like, it made no sense. And so you want to be obsessed with somebody, okay, we're going to show you. We're going to go out here and kick his ass, embarrass you. And to Tony's credit, you know, a lot of players would probably crumble under that pressure. I mean, being attacked for what, 36, 48 minutes of a game, and on a world stage as high as that one was, and being gloated the way that Tony was, and then to be embarrassed. I felt like it took a lot of balls for Tony to come back and prove those guys wrong. And eventually that game, that second game, where he was with Croatia, I felt like built a lot of respect from MJ and from Scotty, and they even kind of mentioned that, which carried over to the Bulls' next three championships, which was very, very cool. The other thing I wanted to talk about too, real quick, we got some funny moments in here, like MJ throwing the quarters at the wall with the security guards and just having this constant need to compete all the time, no matter what. But then we also got the Randy Brown sighting of him trying to get tickets, which I thought was so funny. And then MJ referring to himself as a god. And it was just, that whole sequence was hilarious. And Randy Brown's like, don't shut the cameras off. He's not kidding about that god thing. Don't you dare cut that out. Which I found was too funny. But there's a recurring theme. It's like MJ's always hanging out in that room. It's like almost in ways he was a part owner, part coach, just having his own area and all these players walking in and constantly walking in and out. It's just very, very much a different time. Like, LeBron doesn't have his own room in the Lakers locker room or in the Cavs locker room. It doesn't have control of all these tickets and everything. It's just, I don't know. To me, that whole scene was wild, and I had to laugh about security guards and the Randy Brown story.
Yeah, I mean, Randy Brown, dude, whatever. I'm so jaded about Randy Brown now. I just, like, it's the same thing about, you know, watching Pax hit the three as part of those episodes last night. It's just like the sour taste in my mouth is still there for players like that who went on to have other roles after the good old days that I just don't care about. So, like, I see Randy Brown in the dock and I just roll my eyes. But the MJ gambling, you know, playing pitching quarters with the security guy stuff, I mean, that's like, just upping content, and it so perfectly fits with MJ talking to Ahmad Rashad in that interview before the 93 finals, saying, do I have a gambling problem? No, I have a competition problem. Like, there's exhibit A for that statement right there. It's like, oh, I got a few extra minutes before the game, hanging out with you know, security guys. Yeah, let's play pitch of quarters. And just, you know, obviously a lot of people are getting super interested in becoming with the one particular permed out security guard from some of that footage, who actually has a great story. He sadly passed away earlier this year, right before this documentary was open to the public. But if you want to know more about that, and in particular security guard who was playing pitching quarters with MJ, his name is John Michael Wozniak. He is a Polish Chicagoan who is a former Chicago PD narcotics officer who then went on to be a security guard for a variety of gigs, including the United Center and the old Chicago Stadium, and actually became a personal bodyguard to MJ throughout the years. And Matt Fortuna wrote an amazing column detailing his relationship that lasted several decades with MJ for The Athletic. It's retweeted near the top of my Twitter thread right now, if you're curious. He actually was even still the head security detail for MJ's house in the Burbs in Highland Park, you know, with the famed 23 gate, soon before he had to retire because of his deteriorating health. But a really awesome guy. And like Chicago PD's Twitter account even said, like, yeah, that guy that beat MJ, yeah, he's one of us. So a very fascinating story about that one particular security officer and his relationship with MJ.
Those hairdos were wild, man. Those were some.
Dude, he was the original Joe Exotic.
Those were some insane hairstyles back then, and I'm sure 10 years or 20 years from now, I'll be saying the same thing about some of these people with the, you know, the tight fades on the sides with the hair we haven't cut in 5 years on the top.
Oh my god! And dude, like he's playing pitching quarters with MJ. He beats him and he hits MJ with the shrug.
That's so good.
How awesome was that?
That's so good. And just going off of that, this will be the last thing we kind of talk about. And you know, we can even spill this over into tomorrow's episode because there's so much to talk about with the gambling side of it. And that's the one thing we haven't touched on, which was a huge thing across episode 6. The idea that he would come to the front of the bus on team road trips and we'll produce, like, we're playing for dollars up here and MJ's paying for thousands in the back. But then he'd come up from time to time, be like, hey guys, can I come play in your game? And if I was Paxson or Will Perdue, I would feel like that's such a slap in the face to come up in front of us, be like, yeah, I want to come. I'm going to switch from throwing $100 bills in front of you to dollar bills. But the idea that it goes back to the competition problem is like, I just want to play, not for your money, but just to know that I have your money in my pocket, which I found hilarious. But again, just shows you that's proof and evidence right there that MJ, 100% of the time, no matter what he was doing, always had to compete.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, I love that Will Perdue story got into the doc because I'd heard that from Will. In our first year doing Outsiders, working with him at NBC Sports Go, because, you know, obviously we bug Will for stories about the old days all the time. And he, you know, graciously, you know, humors us, but that exact line, that's how he told that story to us too. He said, you know, I don't care if it's a dollar, I want your money in my pocket. Like, what a badass. That clearly it's not about the money. It's about winning. Which is why I think the whole thing about, you know, his golf gambling buddy, if you want to use that word, even Richard Esquinas, who wrote that book, you know, Michael and Me and My Gambling, My Cry for Help, such, you know, hack job bullshit. Although from what I've talked, so I've been talking to Jack Silverstein, you know, the Bulls historian, great guy, who has his shot on ELO newsletter that all y'all should subscribe to if you can, about that book, which he has, you know, gone back and read recently. He even interviewed the author, Richard Esquinas, the guy who, you know, wrote that scathing book about MJ and their gambling, for some of his work. And it's hard to refute. You know, I'm actually trying to track down a copy of that book right now so I can read it. But suppose, like, everybody took MJ's side, including David Stern, after they did an investigation, quote unquote. But it's clear that MJ got very deeply involved in gambling because it was another form of competition and he was obsessed and addicted to competition.
That's the thing that I have a million questions about, and I know a lot of other people do too. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding MJ's gambling. Like the idea that you can cut your finger on a cigar cutter and be as, I guess, an aficionado. Like MJ wasn't smoking cigars. Like, come on. There's got to be a little more to that. How about the Atlantic City story too, which a lot of people talk about, which I feel like kind of is overblown at the time. And even Phil Jackson told his story about that. But everything else that goes into it, man, the gambling, the idea that MJ didn't piss away a lot of money, but he had the money to piss away. So why not? And I don't remember what I was listening to, but I was listening to them talk about whether or not MJ losing millions of dollars in gambling, but had the money to lose. Does that make him the biggest loser of all time? And it, this weird paradox, or I guess the weird irony that MJ was going out here losing massive amount of money, although he had it. And to him, it was nothing. But to a lot of us looking around, we're like, damn, I don't know if this dude's got a problem or not. But yeah, all this conspiracies that go into the betting side too, Matt. I'm sure we're going to get more this week with people just tweeting threads and other news coming out. But yeah, I think the one thing that I took away from that is there's no denying MJ had some sketchy friends.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, associates, I would say, not friends. Like, of course, you know, the never trust a dude named Slim, right? The guy who was
with the golf bag,
a cocaine trafficker
with the golf bag in the sketch.
Yeah, I mean, and then you know you had like the bail bondsman who you know who showed up, who turned up murdered, and that you know there were checks that Jordan had written to him, and all these sketchy things, and then with his father's murder. After all of this stuff and the book about his gambling and the questions and the Atlantic City and this and that, I think, you know, we're going to start to see some more of that in next week's episodes as far as the real reason MJ walked away. And it wasn't a secret, you know, unofficial suspension from David Stern. Stern, you know, refuted that notion a million times over and said that's preposterous. And I clearly believe that. I don't buy into the conspiracy theory bullshit, but that it was all of these compounding factors of MJ getting sick of these questions and the people prodding into his private life. And do you have a gambling problem? And are you, you know, dealing with seedy people and what, you know? And then when people started trying to connect those dots to his father's murder and like, you know, was it a hit from the mob because of Jordan's gambling debts? That I think, you know, that was like, that was the last straw for Jordan. He had to walk away from that shit.
Makes sense. And like you said, I think there's going to be a lot that comes out over the next few weeks. And it's going to be interesting stories that maybe we've never heard before either, because that's kind of the theme of all this. We're getting stories that we're hearing for the first time and seeing things for the first time as well. But that'll never not interest me, is like the idea of him losing that amount of money or him going and gambling on all these games are just things that we've never heard. Like, how about the David Kaplan story that he told us about a year ago where they're on the 18th green and MJ bets him 50 or bets him $100 that he's going to hit like a 90-foot putt. And Kaplan's like, all right, there's no shot. You're going to hit that. He steps up to the ball, 5 seconds of reading the putt, drills it. Kaplan owes him $100. Like little stories like that where it's just insane that no matter what time of day it was, it could be 2 a.m. It could be 2 p.m. MJ's betting on something. MJ's competing against you in something is going to be, it's going to be telling. It's going to be interesting to read these brand new stories and even kind of uncover the ones that we kind of already know about. But yeah, man, I got a lot of questions, and maybe some of our listeners got questions as well. And if you do, and we'd love to talk about this a little bit more, 331-979-1369, the place to drop us your text, your voicemails, anything you got for us. But I know we left some stuff out, and there's two big important things I want to talk about too, is the creation of the Jordans and the Jordan brand, and also talking about Sam Smith's Jordan Rules book, which played a huge role in these two episodes. So we'll have to get to those on tomorrow or Wednesday's episode. Definitely going to do mailbag this week. So get your questions in either on Twitter
or... Maybe we should talk to Sam about that.
Very true. Very, very, very true. So like we said, maybe we got some interesting guests coming up in the next week or so. Matt, that's definitely a book I'm going to have to go back and reread too. I haven't read the Jordan Rules since high school. So there's things that I definitely forgot that are in that book that I'm going to need to go and refresh myself about. That's for sure.
Great read, man. Great read.
But that's going to about do it here on Locked On Bulls. Hit us up, 331-979-1369. Thanks to Built Bar for sponsoring our episode today and sponsoring all of our shows in the month of May. Again, use the promo code LOCKEDON to get $10 off of your first order when you order from BuiltBar.com, BuiltBar.com. Use the promo code LOCKEDON. Tweet us pictures if you do end up buying from Built Bar. They are fantastic. But for Matt Peck, I'm Jordan Malley, Bulls Nation. Have a wonderful day. Be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. For Jordan and Matt, we are out. Deuces.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com